All right, good morning, everybody. Let's get going with lecture. So start paying attention. Stop making so much noise. It's great to see everybody again. Don't forget, next weekend is a big long weekend. We don't have school a week from today. So this is going to be on the test. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Okay, so today is the 4th. We're going to get into endocrine system today. We're going to finish up special senses. I think I still have to talk about the hearing and some equilibrium senses. And we'll get into endocrine, finish that up on Wednesday, start the heart Wednesday. But anyway, your next lecture exam is going to be a week from this Wednesday, November 13th, exam number 3. And it's going to cover 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. 17 is through endocrine chapter, but not the heart chapter. All right, so don't forget, for your exam, what do you need? Pencil, really good eraser, picture ID, Scantron. Right, pencil, eraser, if I didn't say that, and no hats, hood, sunglasses, that kind of stuff. Okay, and don't forget, a week from today is Veterans Day. Campus is going to be closed. And I don't know if I'm going to have email access or not, but if you have a question, you can try emailing me anyway. Anybody have a question over the schedule? Nobody has a question? Fantastic. Well, this week, we do have practicums this week. We don't have any practicums next week, so this exam and practicums don't conflict with each other. But look at exam number 4, the very last exam. That's going to be on the very last day of class, which is December 11th. So those people that have lab on Wednesday will get a practicum and the last lecture exam on the same day. That's just the way that goes. And if you think that's a really lousy deal, you could tell me, but it won't matter. You could tell the dean, and it won't matter. You probably have to maybe, I don't know who you call, president, something like that, of the college. Okay, or maybe all the other instructors and all the other divisions who thought that was not such a big deal. Okay, but it's a really big deal for science, engineering, and that. Okay, so anybody have any questions over special senses so far? No? Okay. Fantastic. So, we were talking about special senses. And what the heck is a special sense as opposed to a general sense? A general sense is a sensation you have, receptors all over your body. Like, give me one example before we move on.
Pain.
Pain, that's good. Temperature, all right? Proprioception, even though that sounds like a special sense, it's not, because you have proprioceptors in every tendon in your body, and muscle, skeletal muscle. So you have these all over your body, so that is a general sense. Special senses just means that you have receptors in one, maybe two locations. All right, so some of these would be vision. You have two places, but they're very close together. You could think of those as just one place, right, your eyes. And taste, you can only taste with your tongue and smell only with your nose, no other part of your body. All right, hearing is a special sense as well, because if I were to put a speaker or a headset on your kneecap, would you be able to hear it? Or the palm of your hand? Or your back? Or your belly button? All those answers would be no. You can only hear those sounds if we put the headset over your ears. Okay, so that is a special sense. So let's look at the ear. And the ear can be broken down into three main regions. The external ear, starting with the auricle, sometimes we call that the pinna. And the auricle has a number of different divisions. The helix is over here, and the lobe, ear lobe is down over here. I don't think I make such a big deal of the different cartilaginous pieces of the auricle, but you should just know this is the auricle, and it helps funnel sound into the external acoustic meatus or external auditory meatus. And this is a passageway that goes into the temporal bone, but does not go all the way into the brain, because there's some structures, right, that get in the way. It is a canal, and it ends right here at the tympanic membrane. So all of that stuff that we talked about is part of the external ear, and also part of the external ear is a sebaceous gland that secretes sebum into the ear canal, and that's a modified sweat gland, because sebum lubricates this tympanic membrane so that it doesn't crack or fracture. So when sound enters the ear, it vibrates this membrane back and forth because sound is a mechanical wave. It's a pressure wave. It's not like electromagnetic wave that our eye can pick up, but it's actually a physical wave that moves through the medium that we're in. Could move through water, can move through air, but sound can't travel through outer space, for instance, because there are no molecules there. However, sunlight can go through outer space, radio waves, things like that, because it's not a physical wave, it's an electromagnetic wave. All right, so right at the tympanic membrane begins the middle ear. So the middle ear goes from the tympanic membrane to this oval membrane. Sometimes we call this the oval window. So let's talk about some stuff in the middle ear. There are some bones, these are auditory ossicles, and one of the ossicles, namely the malleus, is connected to the tympanic membrane, so the tympanic membrane vibrates back and forth. Those vibrations are picked up by the malleus, then conveyed or conducted into the incus, and then into the stapes, and you can see why that was named the stapes, because it looks like a stirrup that you would use to ride a horse, okay? And so you just put your foot right through there. All right, so those vibrations will vibrate the membrane underneath the stapes, and that's called the oval window. Because look at the footprint of the stapes. What's the shape of this footprint right here? Does it look like a square or a circle or a triangle or what? It looks like an oval, right? And that's how sound enters the inner ear. All right, so here is the inner ear. I want to say a few more things about this middle ear. I might mention some other details about it in a little bit. Okay, but here is a tube, right? Sometimes we call this the auditory tube. Sometimes we call this the eustachian tube. Your book has simplified it and now calls it the pharyngotympanic tube, right? And that's very descriptive. Like if you hear the name of a muscle like sternocleidomastoid, it seems really intimidating, long, right? But it actually is very descriptive. So the pharyngotympanic tube is that way too. It's very descriptive of where it goes. So it really should be your friend. It goes from where? The tympanic membrane down into the pharynx. And maybe you're not so pleased with knowing that because you're not familiar with the pharynx. We haven't talked about the pharynx yet. Does anybody know what the pharynx is? It is your throat, right? So when you have a sore throat, you have a pharyngitis. So this tube goes, right, pretty close to your oral cavity, which has air in it, right? So now you just have atmospheric pressure in your throat, and then, so this chamber should not build up pressure or shouldn't be anything different than atmospheric pressure. Because if it's greater than atmospheric pressure, then it's going to push the tympanic membrane out this way as far as it can go, and then it won't be able to vibrate back and forth. And when it can't vibrate, can you hear anything? The answer is no, right? Or if there's very low pressure in the middle ear because it's not equalizing with the pharynx, then atmospheric pressure is pushing the tympanic membrane all the way in, and again, it can't vibrate, and you won't be able to hear anything. So this pathway is real important to keep atmospheric pressure the same on either side of the tympanic membrane so that it can wiggle back and forth or vibrate back and forth when sound enters the external ear. Okay, so when somebody has an infection of the middle ear, call that otitis media. If you have a bunch of fluid and maybe pus or something in this part of the ear, again, tympanic membrane can't vibrate and you can't hear very well when that happens. All right, so that's the middle ear. It's got these little bones, and I've got all three bones between my fingertip and my thumb tip right here. Right, that's how big they are. They're really small because they fit within the temporal bone. And in particular, what part of the temporal bone is this? Everybody knows because you've been quizzed on it for sure in lab practicum. That's the petrous region of the temporal bone, that thicker region between, exactly between the external acoustic meatus and the internal acoustic meatus, which would be right over here. Right? And that's what a nerve, right? A nerve that comes from the vestibule and the cochlea, that's how that information gets into the brain, the vestibulocochlear nerve. I probably have to know that for the lab practicum. All right, so that takes us into the inner ear. Sound enters via the oval window, enters this little space here, and there it's a what we call a bony labyrinth. Right, so all of these structures have little tiny chambers inside of them. That's why we call it a labyrinth. This is the vestibule, just like sometimes when you walk into a house, there's like an entry room before you get to the rest of the house. We call that a vestibule. And I think that's why they named this the vestibule. This is how sound enters the bony labyrinth. This piece right here that kind of looks like a snail, that's the cochlea. And then you see two of the three semicircular canals. So the semicircular canal gives you a particular special sense. The vestibule gives you a second equilibrium sense. And then the third special sense, hearing, is provided to you by the cochlea. That's the bony labyrinth. All right. I didn't mention this, and I want to mention this a couple of times. So semicircular canals and vestibule don't help you with hearing, but give you a sense of equilibrium so you don't lose your balance. And we talk about those two different kinds of equilibrium in different ways. Right? So the vestibule is important for linear acceleration. Right? If you're going to move forward or backwards, or if you're going to lie down, then gravity acts like acceleration, right? So you know what position your head is in. Just linear acceleration. Not speed, but acceleration. The semicircular canals are important for acceleration, but not linear acceleration. It's going to be spinning or twirling. Right? So we call that angular acceleration. So the two senses in the vestibule and semicircular canals are both equilibrium, but one is linear due to the vestibule, and angular is due to the semicircular canals. And hearing is due to the cochlea. All right, so make sure you know the three parts of the ear in general. All right, I might come back to this slide in a little bit. All right, so here is that middle ear once again. And here we can see a couple muscles, like the tensor tympani muscle is connected to the malleus. And the stapes has a stapedius muscle. Right, and so these muscles can contract when you experience damaging levels of sound. If sound is too loud, it can damage the cochlea. And so these muscles then put some tension on these auditory ossicles so that attenuates sound before it gets into the cochlea. And you're probably aware of these things because maybe first thing in the morning when you go into your car and turn your car on, what invariably is the state of your car when you first turn it on in the morning? Yeah, it's like my wild nephew was driving it all night long and turned the stereo volume all the way up to maximum, right? Because you hear this really loud sound. You go, I can't believe I was listening to music that loud. And you turn it down because these muscles haven't adjusted to all the road noise and loud sounds coming from your radio speakers. Okay, so don't forget about these muscles in the inner chamber of the ear. Okay. So, what should we talk about? We're going to talk about hearing first, which is due to the cochlea, this thing that looks like a snail. And we can see that here is the cochlear nerve leaving the cochlea, and that's the nerve that allows you to hear. This sends signals to the auditory cortex. Maybe you could remember the auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe, right about in this location. And This reminds me of a musical instrument that has all been curled up on itself. We could unwind this cochlea, and let's take a look and see what it looks like when it's unwound. Okay, you can see that we're in the process of unwinding it here. And the way the cochlea works is that when sound enters the oval window, high frequencies move across this inner tube about in this region that's very close to the oval window. And then low frequencies have to travel all the way into the end that we call the helicotrema, okay, before they can cut across what we call the cochlear duct, right, and stimulates this part of the cochlea. And then mid-range frequencies stimulate this region of the cochlear duct. So high frequencies here, mid-range frequencies here, and low-range frequencies way over here. What kind of instrument does that remind you of? What does that remind you of? Where one end of the instrument, you can play low notes, and then on the other end, you can play really a high frequency or high pitch notes. A piano, exactly right. And as a matter of fact, when I see this cochlea that's unwound, I actually see a piano, right? So you actually have a piano inside both of your ears, inside the cochlea, that are sensitive to sound by frequency. So depending on the frequency, right, different parts of this cochlea will be stimulated, and then different impulses will be sent to different parts of the brain, and in your brain you have two pianos as well that respond to these electrical signals to give you the appreciation of these various tones. Okay, so what can we say about this? Well, this inner chamber, or this chamber right here where I have the cursor, this is what we call the scala vestibuli, even though it's connected to the oval window. Okay, this is the vestibuli. This is how sound enters. Then it's going to cut across the cochlear duct, depending on the frequency, and then it's going to enter the scala tympani. Right? And don't forget that sound is energy. If it was trapped inside the cochlea, then it's going to damage something or fracture maybe the bony labyrinth or really damage the cochlea. So that sound, when it enters the scala tympani, has to exit the cochlea, and here it can exit through the round window. Round window can vibrate back and forth, right, releasing that energy. So that's important to have. So on the bony labyrinth, you have the entry of sound from the oval window, and it leads through the round window. Both of these are on the vestibule. Okay, so let's go back and look at this cochlear duct. It has a number of different features associated with it, and okay, there is, that cochlear duct is made up of what we call the membranous labyrinth. So the membranous labyrinth is inside the bony labyrinth. What did we say the bony labyrinth was right here? That was the thing that looks like a snail. That's the cochlea, and inside of it is that membranous labyrinth, right? That is the cochlear duct. So here we see the cochlear duct, and in this region we have receptors that can pick up vibrations. So let's zoom into this region right over here. All right, so we've zoomed in. Here is the cochlear duct. This right here is the organ that vibrates back and forth when sound crosses from the scala vestibuli into the scala tympani. It moves right across. All depends on how far away it is from the helicotrema or how close it is, right? And when sound moves across this area, the tectorial membrane is going to vibrate back and forth. And that tectorial membrane, I'm going to have to zoom in even a little bit further. Right, here's that tectorial membrane. You can see that there are some things attached to it. So these right here are cells that can pick up those vibrations. They have little cilia coming off of them, and we call these stereocilia. They're special kind of like hairs, and they reminded somebody of hair coming off this cell, and so they call these receptor cells hair cells. Hair cells are used for hearing. But remember, these really aren't hair like you have on your head. These are more like cilia. And when they bend, they change the electrical property of this receptor cell, which then sends electrical information down the cochlear nerve to the temporal lobe where you can appreciate sound. Okay, so that's pretty much what I want you to know about the organ of Corti. It has this tectorial membrane. It's got also this basement membrane, basilar membrane, and it's got these hair cells that are attached to the tectorial membrane. So when the tectorial membrane vibrates, right, it sends electrical information to the temporal lobe. All right, so this is the organ for hearing. So it's not labeled on the slide, but what is this organ? What did I call this organ? I do want you to know. And that's called the organ of Corti. Inside the membranous labyrinth, inside the what? The cochlear duct. And the cochlear duct is inside which bony labyrinth? The cochlea. Okay. And the nerve that carries that information is the cochlear nerve. It's a division of cranial nerve number 8. And remember, cranial nerve number 8, you had to learn that is the vestibulocochlear nerve, because part of it comes from the cochlea and the other part comes from the other part of the bony labyrinth in the inner ear, the vestibule. All right, so that's hearing pretty much. Let me see if I can show you where that temporal lobe is. Kind of. All right, so here's that organ of Corti, right? And it comes in the medulla, goes up to the midbrain, and of course goes to the inferior colliculus, because what does that inferior colliculus allow us to do? To localize sound from what direction, right? So these colliculi are comparing sound from one side to the other, and you can tell where that sound is coming from. And then that sends a signal up to this relay station. Anybody remember what this relay station is called? Probably you should know. That is the thalamus, right? And then the thalamus sends the signals to the temporal lobe. So here's the primary auditory cortex in the temporal lobe. And there's a high frequency part, then a mid-range frequency part, and then a low frequency part. So these are the parts of the brain that are stimulated when you hear tones. So remember, it's not the organ that allows you to perceive a certain sensation. All right, it is the part of the cerebral cortex that allows you that kind of appreciation. If we took this nerve, which is getting signals from the organ of Corti, if we took this nerve right here from the thalamus, and normally it goes to the temporal lobe, but if we took it from there and placed it in the occipital lobe, right, when sound entered the ear, what would be your experience? Okay? Because it's the occipital lobe is receiving that electrical information, that would produce some kind of visual experience, because that's where your visual cortex is. Right? And the language of these neurons is exactly the same. Physiology, you're going to see that that is what we call an action potential. So the part of the brain determines what your sensory perception is going to be, or what that modality is going to be. Same thing, if we were to take nerves from the eye, and instead of going to the occipital lobe, if we took those nerves and brought them over here to the temporal lobe, whenever light was shined in your eye, what would be your experience? You would hear something, right? You wouldn't see anything. Again, it's a part of the cerebral cortex that's stimulated that determines the sensation that you have. Okay, here's a sign-in sheet, which I forgot to pass around, but we'll pass that around right now. All right, so that is hearing. So what's important for you to know about hearing? Well, you should know those ducts, right? So starting with the oval window, here's the scala vestibuli. And then way on the other end is the scala tympani. The cochlear duct is in the middle. Sound has to pass through that cochlear duct, and that's where the organ of Corti is, right, within the cochlear duct. So that cochlear duct is part of the membranous labyrinth inside the cochlea. So why do you think the cochlea actually looks like a snail? Okay. Why does it look like this? Why is it all curled up on itself? Because if it was really straight, you would have like these two pianos sticking out of your head like that, right? And it would be really easy to break off. So evolution has figured out a way to take this big, long, linear structure and curl it up so that it fits into a small space, namely what, the petrous region of the temporal bone. All right, so that's pretty good for hearing. We have a couple other membranous labyrinths. We've got one in the vestibule, okay? And I see the utricle and saccule. And the utricle and saccule give us the sense of linear acceleration, and linear acceleration sometimes we call static equilibrium. All right, so I do want you to know that. All right, static equilibrium, it's in your notes right here. Within the vestibule, another name for static equilibrium, and you might want to write this down in your notes because I think maybe your book talks about it this way, they call that linear acceleration. Static equilibrium and linear acceleration are the same thing. And we have two organs for linear acceleration, and they both contain a similar kind of organ that we call a maculae. So there's a maculae in the utricle, and there's a maculae in the saccule. And these respond to gravity because gravity acts like acceleration on our body, or actually on everything. So let's take a look at what these things look like. And I got to go this direction. Okay. All right, so here is the macula of the utricle. Here's the macula of the saccule. These are very similar kinds of organs, but they have different orientation. One is vertical, one is more horizontal. Let's look at the more horizontal one. All right, so here is a nice basement membrane. And again, here are the receptor cells with stereocilia on them. So if you're going to take a look at these cells with all these stereocilia on them, what might you want to call these receptor cells? They're hair cells, right? Just like what we saw in the cochlea. Right, there are hair cells, right? But they're not connected to a tectorial membrane. They're connected to a gelatinous mass. So here's a nice gelatinous mass. We call that the otolith membrane. And an otolith is a little tiny crystal. And I see otoliths, you can see these little tiny crystals embedded in the otolith membrane. And these otoliths right here are little tiny weights, which gravity can pull on. So when your head is in this position and the otoliths are pushing straight down on the stereocilia, they really don't bend one way or the other. But if you bend your head forward, so instead of being horizontal now, this otolithic membrane is vertical, then the otoliths are going to be pulled down, and that's going to bend these stereocilia. It's going to change the electrical properties of this hair cell, which then will send electrical impulses to the equilibrium part of your brain. Right, so here you can see that otolithic membrane with the hair cells, and when you turn your head forward, look at these stereocilia. They start to bend, and depending on which way they bend, they send different kinds of signals to the brain so that you know if your head is tilting backwards or forwards, or even if maybe you're accelerating on a motorcycle or something like that with the otolithic membrane still in a horizontal position. All right, so both of those, so this is what we call a macula, right? So the maculae in the utricle and saccule are the organs for linear acceleration. And those crystals are just calcium carbonate crystals, and they should stay glued to the otolithic membrane, but sometimes they don't. Maybe I can remember what happens to a person when they break away, and it could be due to head trauma, or it could just be due to everyday circumstances. Every once in a while, some of these will break away. And it won't affect your sense of linear acceleration, but it will affect your sense of angular acceleration, or spinning. All right, so let's go to the last organ, right? And that is the organ that is inside the semicircular canals. And you can see all three semicircular canals, and they're oriented perpendicular to each other. So depending on which way you're spinning, okay, head over heels or right to left, right, there are three planes that you can spin in, and each of these semicircular canals will send signals to the brain that will tell the brain when you start spinning or stop spinning, right? Because that's acceleration. When there's a change in the rate of velocity or the rate of twisting, for instance, in the semicircular canals. So there is fluid in these semicircular canals, and since they're a circle, that fluid can flow around in a circle. And there is an organ right in the ampule of a semicircular canal. Remember, an ampule is bulged right at the base of a semicircular canal because there's stuff inside there. What's in there is the crista ampullaris. And here is an enlargement of the crista ampullaris. And I can see the basement membrane once again. And I can see some receptor cells with stereocilia on them poking up into this gelatinous mass that we call the cupula. It doesn't completely block the semicircular canals. Fluid can still flow over the cupula in this region over here and then in this region over here. But this cupula is sticking way up into the center of a semicircular canal. And the cupula is kind of bendy, so when fluid flows over it, it's going to bend one way or the other. And when it bends, these receptor cells get stimulated. Right? And since they have stereocilia on them, guess what we like to call these receptor cells? Are you kidding me? A hair cell? Another hair cell? And you're going to say, well, of course it's a hair cell because it has stereocilia. Just like in what? The maculae. Just like in the organ of Corti. The same kind of cells, right, used for different modalities of energy. It's pretty fascinating. Here is not hearing. This is what we call angular acceleration. All right, and I'm sure you all are very familiar with this. Probably it's something that you did over the weekend, or maybe this weekend coming up you're looking forward to doing this because it's a long weekend. This can give you an altered sense of consciousness when we stimulate these hair cells, right, or when we start spinning. So when we start spinning, right, that fluid in, or the endolymph inside the semicircular canals likes to stay stationary. But when we start to spin, the crista ampullaris goes with our body because it's connected to our body. And then it's like fluid flowing over the crista ampullaris when we start to spin. because of that property of matter that we call inertia. Inertia just means that when you have matter that's not moving, it likes to stay stationary, or it doesn't like to move. But once you get matter moving in a certain direction, that same property of inertia means that matter likes to keep moving in that same direction. It doesn't really like to stop unless there's some kind of friction, and things typically start to slow down. All right, so here is that endolymph. When we're stationary, it's not moving. The cupula is pointing straight up. But when we start to spin, okay, that endolymph likes to stay stationary, but the crista ampullaris, because we're spinning, is moving, right? So the crista ampullaris is moving with respect to the endolymph, and that bends the cupula over, like so. And then that sends spinning information to your brain so that you don't lose your balance. All right, and then let's just say that you spin for a long period of time, like maybe 10 seconds or 15 seconds. By that time, then, this endolymph has caught up to the crista ampullaris. It eventually starts to spin along with the crista ampullaris, and then you stop all of a sudden. That stops the crista ampullaris, right, because that temporal bone isn't moving. But now what can you tell me about that endolymph? It was moving over here, but you stop. Now it starts to move, right? It looks like it's going to move in the opposite direction. And when you open your eyes, guess what that looks like? The world is spinning the opposite direction until the endolymph then stops moving, you know, after a second or so. All right, so we said that was a property of inertia. So I don't know, I think maybe I should demonstrate what inertia is for you guys, okay? All right, so what did I say? Two things about inertia. What are two things about inertia? It has to do with matter. But what are the two things with matter? Here's matter right here. It just means that matter, if it's stationary, it just likes to stay stationary. Right? So here is that bottle. And you could think of this bottle as being endolymph inside your ear. And the white piece of paper could be the crista ampullaris, which is really attached to your body. When you start to spin, your body moves. Right? But what about the endolymph? It doesn't move because it has inertia. So let's see what's coming. Ah, Thanksgiving, just a couple of weeks. I expect you all to do the same experiment at home. Okay? So you can have a nice table, maybe a little bit bigger than this one, but a tablecloth, right? And candle holders, wine glasses, bottle of wine, some other stuff on the table, silverware, and a plate. And I want you to take that tablecloth and remove it from the table without affecting anything on the table. Because all of those objects that I mentioned have inertia, right? Which means what? They're stationary, they don't want to move. So what would you do? You would grab that tablecloth and you just go like that. Okay, so here's your crista ampullaris. It's moved very quickly, but what about the endolymph inside your ear? Just like the candlesticks on the table. They don't move. Right? And when this moves and the endolymph doesn't move, the cupula bends in one direction, and that gives you a sense of spinning. All right, so that's one property of inertia. Once matter is stationary, it doesn't like to move. But what happens when you get matter moving? What's the second part of inertia? Matter means that it likes to stay moving in that same direction. So how can we demonstrate that? So here's that endolymph once again. Here's the crista ampullaris, and let's start spinning, so I'm going to move the crista ampullaris, but then I'm going to stop the crista ampullaris quickly. What do you think is going to happen to the endolymph? It's going to keep moving, right, until the friction slows it down. So I'm going to start slow. I want to give myself a big runway right here. So we're going to move fast and then stop. Oh, I didn't stop the crista ampullaris. Okay, I need more practice. Stop. Whoa, like that. Okay, so then that's going to bend the stereocilia the other way, and if you open your eyes, that information then is going to confound what your eyes see, and it's going to give you that spinning sensation. All right, so don't forget, matter likes to stay stationary, if it's stationary, or it likes to continue moving once it starts to move. And so consider this the endolymph, and this white piece of paper, the crista ampullaris. Do you believe me about inertia or not? Yet. Maybe. I showed you right there. Okay, but nonetheless, you got to know the parts of the crista ampullaris. The crista ampullaris is the organ for spinning or change in spinning. We call that angular acceleration. And what's the receptor cell for angular acceleration? What's the receptor cell? I see it on the slide right here. What's this receptor cell? I promise, I made fun of you the first time, but I won't now. Somebody just says it. It's what? It's a hair cell, right, for angular acceleration. All right, what's the receptor cell for linear acceleration? It's a hair cell. And what is the receptor cell for hearing? It's a hair cell once again, right? They're connected up to different kinds of membranes and other kind of structures, right? And it gives you much different senses. It's sort of ingenious how that was all put together. All right, well, we see that the endolymph has to flow through a semicircular canal, right, past the cupula right here. And remember, in the maculae, there are otoliths, those little crystals. And if some of those break away and end up going into a semicircular canal, then it can block, right, the flow of endolymph through that semicircular canal, or it can even get lodged between the cupula and maybe the roof of the ampule and bend the hair cells. And when those hair cells are bent, what does your brain experience? It experiences spinning, right? So even though you're stationary and you get some of those otoliths embedded inappropriately into a semicircular canal, it will give you the sense or the disequilibrium sense that you're spinning even though you're not spinning, right? And that can be really severe. Sometimes people can't even stand up when they get an otolith trapped in a semicircular canal or anywhere near this crista ampullaris. Fortunately, it usually dislodges, right, and then your body resorbs it. It usually goes away. But while that's happening, it is very disturbing because people lose equilibrium. All right, so let's see. What do we got? We got like three parts of the ear. Let's go back to the three parts of the ear. All right, what are the three parts of the ear once again? Three parts of the ear. Here we go. Okay, we got external, middle, and inner. Okay, and so we got three parts to the ear, and it just so happens that we have three senses from the ear. What are the three senses? Hearing, okay, and we have linear acceleration or static equilibrium, and then we also have angular acceleration. I pointed to these three areas. All right, so what I'm pointing to right here are what we call the bony labyrinth. What's the bony labyrinth for hearing? Cochlea. What's the bony labyrinth for linear acceleration? Vestibule. And the bony labyrinth for angular acceleration? Semicircular canals. Okay. So another question that sometimes I like to ask, since we have three parts of the ear, in order for you to hear, which parts of this ear, of these three, do you need in order to hear something? You need all three. You need the external, you need the middle functioning properly, and you need the inner ear, right? Because sometimes sound doesn't get conducted through the middle ear, and that produces something we call conduction deafness, right? And maybe sometimes you get a viral infection of that cochlear duct or organ of Corti, right? And that produces a different kind of deafness in people. All right, so for hearing, you need all three. What about for the sense of linear acceleration or the vestibule? What parts of these three do you need for that sense? You don't need the external, don't need the middle. All you need is the vestibule, the inner part, only that one sense. All right, you just need the maculae and those otoliths in this location. All right, so I want to ask you the same question with regard to the sense of angular acceleration. Which three parts of the ear do you need in order to maintain equilibrium when you start spinning or stop spinning? Do you need this auricle? No, you don't need an external acoustic meatus, so you don't need an external ear. What about these auditory ossicles? Nope, don't need those either. All you need is what? The inner ear, in particular the semicircular canals connected up to the ampule right here, the crista ampullaris. All right, so you should know the bony labyrinth. You should know the receptor organs. What's the receptor organ for hearing? And you know hearing is in the cochlea. That is the organ of Corti. What's the organ for hearing in the vestibule? Not hearing. The organ for linear acceleration or static equilibrium in the vestibule? maculi, right? And the organ for appreciating angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium, that is the crista ampullaris. Yeah, crista ampullaris. And what's the receptor cell in the crista ampullaris? Hair cell. What's the receptor cell in the vestibule? Hair cell. What's the receptor cell in the cochlea? Hair cell. Yeah, exactly right. Okay, so that's it for the three senses of the ear. It is hearing, right? Hearing, which requires all three parts, and then balance. There's two kinds of balance, right? Static equilibrium and kinetic. Another name for static is linear acceleration. Another name for kinetic equilibrium is angular acceleration. All right, so that's it for the senses chapter. Okay. So, and you know what the exam diagrams are for this particular chapter. Certainly the eyeball. I'm sure this is it, one, two as well. All right. So, what's the next chapter? Da-da-da-da, here it is. It is the endocrine system. All right, so this is the last chapter that's going to be on the test. We studied the nervous system. We had a bunch of chapters on nervous system. And let's just kind of think about the nervous system a little bit. All right, it controls or ties together various parts of your body. All right, so the nervous system can initiate skeletal muscle movement. And does anybody know what part of the brain is responsible for telling skeletal muscle to contract? What part of the brain is that? And that's what? That's an efferent. It's a motor pathway. Voluntary motor. What's the voluntary motor part of the cerebrum? That's the precentral gyrus, right? Is the primary motor cortex. And for instance, when your nervous system wants to send a signal to this biceps right here to contract, starts in the precentral gyrus in the frontal lobe, then it goes to the biceps, biceps contracts. How fast is that? Does it take a week? No. Does it take a day? No. How about a second? Less than a second, right? So nervous system is fast. It can send information long distances very rapidly. Right, but the duration of action is very short. So when I tell that biceps to contract, it contracts, but if I don't tell it to keep contracting, guess what? It's going to relax almost immediately. Right? And then I can tell it to contract again, and then it relaxes. Right? So nervous system controls all the different, it connects all the different parts of your body and can coordinate those different parts very rapidly via electrical information. We call those action potentials. But the trade-off is, or one thing is that it can only control things for a very short period of time. So if you need to control things for a long period of time, then we need a different kind of control system, and that is the endocrine system. The endocrine system sends signals, right, not as electrical signals, but as chemical signals, or chemical messengers. All right, so there could be a chemical messenger, for instance. Come on, cursor. Could be electric. There could be a chemical signal released by the pituitary gland, and you're kind of familiar with where the pituitary gland is. The pituitary gland might send signals, control signals down over here to an ovary or to a testes, right? So these are what we call gonads. Here's a female gonad. Here's a male gonad. All right. But when the pituitary gland sends a signal down here to these gonads, does it arrive in a split second? No, right? Because it sends a chemical messenger that we call a hormone, and that hormone has to be absorbed by the blood, and then the blood has to transport it to these various organs, right? And then that hormone has to bind to something on that organ, for instance, a receptor. And then that receptor can change the physiology of these different organs. So that takes time. The other thing is that chemical signal might last or persist in the blood for a relatively long period of time. So the endocrine system can control things for a long period of time, but what's the onset of action? Can it do it immediately? No. But that's okay, because what kind of nervous system do you have that can take care of something immediately? The nervous system, right? So these two systems kind of go hand in hand. All right, so here we have a number of endocrine glands, and let's contrast an endocrine gland with an exocrine gland. Let's start with an exocrine gland. You had to know this way back in chapter 1 or 2 maybe, 3, 4. Anyway, you got to know it in this chapter, which is 17. You should know it in all these chapters. What's an exocrine gland? It's a gland that produces a product and secretes it, but the trick there is to know where it is secreted if it's an exocrine gland. It's secreted into a duct, and that duct carries it to some part of the body where it's going to do its job. Like a sweat gland takes sweat down in your dermis, right? Takes it to the surface of your skin via a duct, and then sweat is released on the surface of your skin to cool you down. That's an exocrine gland. As opposed to the glands that we see on this page. All these glands produce a product, right, and release it or secrete that product, but it isn't carried by a duct to where it's going to have an effect. It's carried by what? The vascular system. It's carried by the blood. So, for instance, if the pancreas releases a hormone, and that hormone gets into the blood, then where does it go? Everywhere where the blood goes, right, which is most places. Right, so that's what an endocrine gland is. It's a ductless gland, and it doesn't need ducts because it uses the vascular system to deliver things. All right, so here are some glands that you should be familiar with. The adrenal glands. There's two parts to the adrenal gland we're going to look at. Pancreas, does anybody know what hormone? Oh, yeah, that signaling compound. I forgot to mention that. That signaling compound that is secreted by an endocrine gland is called a hormone, right? So you got to remember, a hormone gets transported via the vascular system all over the body. And a hormone is produced by an endocrine gland. So that hormone is going to travel to some distant site, change the physiology of some tissue, like for instance this ovary right here. But in order for the ovary to be sensitive to a particular hormone, what does it have to have? That's right. Just like your eyes, in order to perceive light, have to have a receptor, right? Every time we start a response loop to appreciate some kind of stimulus, you need a receptor. So, for instance, in the ovary right here, there have to be receptors from the pituitary gland. Otherwise, it will ignore all of the signals, right, that are being released from the pituitary gland. It's got to have a receptor. And only certain tissues have receptors. So what are some other glands? Oh, no, I was asking you, what kind of hormone is released by the pancreas? Probably all know. That is insulin, which helps regulate blood glucose levels. Right? Insulin is a passport that allows most cells in your body to take glucose up from the blood. That's a passport signal. So if the pancreas isn't producing any insulin and you have glucose in your blood, what happens to it? It stays in your blood. It can't get into cells. So your cells actually begin to starve because they don't have glucose. So now you can kind of appreciate how important that is, right? And that signal insulin comes from the pancreas. Some of these hormones operate in antagonistic pairs. Can you give me an antagonistic pair of muscles, for instance? Biceps and triceps. And they work against each other. Why is that such a good thing? Because if they're antagonistic muscles, then you have precise control and balance of where this fingertip is going, right? Just like your car has antagonistic mechanisms. So you have precise control and balance of your car, which is what? Gas pedal and brake pedal. You'd never dream of driving your car if you didn't have both of those things together. All right, same thing for maintaining blood glucose concentrations. There are two hormones from the pancreas, not just one. You have insulin, which is one which decreases blood glucose, and then you have another one that's called glucagon. Probably haven't heard of glucagon. Glucagon has the opposite effect of insulin. It increases blood glucose concentration. For instance, when you're in a fasted state, the pancreas releases glucagon, and then that tells the liver to break down glycogen and put that breakdown product, which is glucose, into the blood when you're in a fasted state, so that blood glucose doesn't decrease too much. So a number of endocrine systems, right, work by that property of antagonism if it's a very important kind of process. And of course, blood glucose is. All right, so what are some endocrine glands we see? Well, we got gonads here, pancreas, kidneys are an important endocrine gland, adrenal glands on top, Here's the thymus gland that's in the mediastinum. Oh, I should have asked you. The mediastinum. Then here we have the thyroid gland on either side of the thyroid cartilage. And we have some parathyroid glands that regulate blood calcium levels, which is parathyroid hormone. And then there's another hormone secreted by the thyroid gland that has the opposite effect of parathyroid. Right, so both of these working together maintain proper levels of calcium in your blood. Parts of the brain that are endocrine glands, for instance, the pineal gland and the hypothalamus and the pituitary, you should kind of know where those are. And now we're going to talk about what some of these functions are. All right, so the endocrine gland is composed of what, ductless glands, and what kind of product do they secrete? A hormone. Right, and how does it travel through your body? Through the bloodstream, and it goes to a distant site on your body, and it controls some distant cells in your body because those cells have a receptor to that particular hormone. Right, and that receptor has to be complementary in shape. So it's the shape of the molecule that determines whether it can bind to a receptor and then change the physiology of that particular cell. All right, so let's look at some functions. Regulates relatively slow processes because we know the nervous system controls fast processes. Growth is a long-term process. Metabolism is long-term. Reproductive system is long-term. So these are all controlled by the endocrine system. Even blood chemistry controlled by the endocrine system and immune response as well, how your body fights infection. All right, so here is a partial list of endocrine organs. We mentioned the pituitary, the adrenal gland, all right, which we see right above the kidneys here. It's got two parts. It's got a deep part and a superficial part. What do we call the superficial part of any organ? The cortex, right? So we got adrenal cortex, which is superficial, and an adrenal medulla, which is deep. And we talked about the adrenal medulla already in terms of an autonomic nervous system. What part of the autonomic nervous system is related to the adrenal medulla? Sympathetic. Remember, autonomic nervous system has two divisions, parasympathetic and sympathetic, and the adrenal medulla is an important part of the sympathetic nervous system. We just got done talking about the pancreas, right? And you know where these other things are now, thymus and hypothalamus, and gonads. Another name for a gonad is an orchid. All right, so if for some reason this testes has to be removed, that's an orchidectomy, right? Or an ovary has to be removed, that's an orchidectomy. Could be due to cancer or other kinds of things. Other important endocrine glands are the heart. The heart secretes a hormone. Digestive tract secretes a number. The kidneys. And also your skin secretes hormones. Most of these glands come from epithelium, but some are derived from nervous tissue, and maybe from muscle, and maybe from connective tissue. But by far, most come from epithelium, not the other three kinds of tissues that in your body. Some hormones, right, are steroids, and steroids are all derived from cholesterol. Cholesterol is a fat, right, and they all have a particular shape to them. Other hormones are based on amino acids. And amino acid is a building block for another important biological compound in your body, which probably everybody knows, but maybe you haven't thought about it this way. Okay? What if we put amino acids together, or if your body does, what is your body making? Proteins, that's right. Usually somebody asks you, what's the building block of a protein? You would say amino acids, right? But I just asked it the other way around. So some amino acids or some really small proteins can act as hormones as well. All right, control of hormone secretion. We got three ways that hormone secretion is controlled. We see it nicely on this slide right here. We've got humoral, neural, and hormonal. What that means is that there can be an endocrine gland, like if it's hormonal, there can be an endocrine gland that is told to secrete a hormone based on the levels of another hormone. That means that it's being controlled by a hormone. Some good examples would be, for instance, the anterior, here's a pituitary, here's a hypothalamus. What's that connection between the hypothalamus and pituitary gland once again? infundibulum, right, or the stalk of the pituitary. That's good. I'm glad nobody said, I forget, peduncolito. Yeah, I'm glad nobody said that. Okay. So here's that anterior pituitary. Hypothalamus is going to tell the anterior pituitary to release a hormone, right? And when it releases a hormone, where does it go? In the blood, right? And it travels everywhere in your body. Some of the hormones go to the thyroid gland to tell the thyroid gland to secrete another hormone. That's what we call hormonal stimulus, right? Because the thyroid gland is releasing its hormone because a hormone from the anterior pituitary is telling it to do so. Same thing for the adrenal cortex. The adrenal cortex secretes a hormone, but only when a different hormone from the anterior pituitary tells it to do so. Right? And the same thing for the gonads. In this particular case, here is a testes. It's going to release hormones, like, for instance, testosterone, but only when there's another hormone from the anterior pituitary, a different hormone, tells the testes to release testosterone. So these are three examples of hormonal stimulus. All right, what about neural stimulus? We kind of talked about this already. All right, neural stimulus means that there is a nerve impulse that tells an endocrine gland to secrete its product, which is a hormone. So here is a sympathetic nerve fiber, and we're ignoring the sympathetic chain, right, and the splanchnic nerve. But here's that preganglionic fiber going all the way into the adrenal medulla. And when these chromaffin cells, right, are stimulated, right, they don't send more electrical impulses, right? They're not really postganglionic cells. These are really endocrine cells that secrete norepinephrine and epinephrine. They're picked up by a capillary, and then epinephrine and norepinephrine go everywhere in the body carrying that sympathetic signal, right? Under what kind of response? What kind of situation would somebody be in would stimulate the adrenal medulla to release fight or flight response? That's right. Any kind of really stressful stimulus is going to cause release of these, what we call catecholamines, epinephrine and norepinephrine, or more commonly called adrenaline and noradrenaline. But people usually don't talk about noradrenaline, but it's both epinephrine and norepinephrine. So that would be a neural control. Humoral control means that there is some other metabolite in the body that's going to cause secretion of a hormone. And it could be maybe a decrease in a certain chemical is going to cause a release of a hormone from an organ. And you could probably give me an example, because we've talked about that already today. What would be a good example of humoral, which means that there is a chemical in your body, which is not a hormone, right, that's going to cause an endocrine gland to secrete something. And I'm thinking pancreas. That's a hint. What's a pancreas sensitive to? It can measure. What can it measure in your blood? Yeah, glucose, right? And when blood glucose goes up, the pancreas then releases insulin, and insulin tells other cells in your body to absorb that glucose so it doesn't go too high. But more importantly then, the cells don't starve to death, right? So that's important. Or if blood glucose goes too low, then the pancreas is going to secrete glucagon. All right, so that's what we call humoral stimulus. But here is another example. Okay, here are the parathyroid glands in the thyroid and the posterior part of the thyroid gland. And when calcium is low in the blood, the parathyroid glands can measure that decrease in calcium, and parathyroid glands are going to release parathyroid hormone. Parathyroid hormone is going to go to bones, namely a type of cell in bone that tells that cell to break bone down. And what's one building block of bone? Calcium. And when that bone is broken down by that cell, then blood calcium levels increase. At the expense of what? Of your bone. That's right. But you got to maintain blood calcium levels. All right, so that's parathyroid hormone. What did I want to ask you? I wanted to ask you something. I forgot what it was. Oh, well. Probably not too important. I think I just lost the cursor altogether. Okay. All right, so I'm going to go over here because I have a mouse over here. Unless somebody has a USB mouse handy. But I think I can do it from over here. Right. Don't forget, I have the sign-in sheet right here. When we're done, put that mouse back in the cradle. All right, so those are the three kinds of stimuli that can release hormones. So let's look at the pituitary gland. And pituitary gland secretes 9 major hormones. There's some minor ones. And you know the pituitary gland is attached to the hypothalamus by the stalk or the infundibulum. And there are 2 major parts to the pituitary gland. And I see it on this slide, but I'm gonna scoot over to another slide really soon. All right, so this is the anterior. Over here is posterior, so we see the anterior pituitary is different than the posterior pituitary. They secrete different kinds of hormones by different mechanisms. Let me move this chair out of the way. All right, the anterior pituitary is made out of, is made out of glandular tissue. And that's why we call that the adenohypophysis. So here we have the adenohypophysis. It's made out of epithelium. It has its epithelium in origin. The posterior pituitary really is made from central nervous system, nervous tissue. So a totally different kind of tissue. Even though it's one gland that functions together, you should be aware that it's really 2 separate glands that have been glued together. Right? And these hormones control other things in your body, which we're going to talk about. All right, so it has 2 basic divisions. Adenohypophysis, same thing as anterior lobe, and the neurohypophysis, because it's made out of brain tissue, which is the posterior lobe. Right here. I'll figure out how to use this cursor pretty soon. Okay, so neurohypophysis and posterior are the same. Adeno and anterior lobe are the same as well. I don't really care so much that you know even some of the subdivisions. All right. I can't see this over here very well. Maybe if I stand here. All right, so here's your pituitary. Which part of the pituitary is this? Right where I have the cursor. Anterior, adenohypophysis, and here is the posterior, okay, or the neurohypophysis. And hypophysis, you can kind of tell, hypo means, like a hypodermic, it means below, right? And so it just means below the hypothalamus. Okay, so what are some of the hormones? We're going to talk about these hormones by what lobe they come from. That's a nice view right there. Okay. In particular, let's talk about the anterior lobe first. So here are some of the hormones. We have growth hormone. Sometimes we call that somatotropic hormone or somatotropin because what does soma mean once again? It means body, right? So this hormone helps your body grow, stimulates bone growth and muscle growth, especially during development. That's important. Thyroid-stimulating hormone is secreted by the anterior pituitary. And remember, and we just call that TSH. So TSH from the anterior pituitary goes in the blood. And where does it have an effect? The thyroid. It tells the thyroid to grow, to maintain itself, but also to secrete thyroid hormone. Right, so that's another example of hormonal control. Adrenal corticotropic hormone. See, the name tells you where it's going. It's coming from the anterior lobe, and it's going to the adrenal cortex. And it tells the adrenal cortex to maintain itself and to grow and to secrete other hormones. And those other hormones, we'll talk about their mineralocorticoids and glucocorticoids. We'll give you some examples. Melanocyte-stimulating hormone comes from the anterior pituitary, which stimulates melanocytes. And you know what a melanocyte does? What does a melanocyte do? Produces melanin, right? And melanocytes also produce a hormone called melatonin, which can help regulate sleep cycles in people. And gonadotropins come from the anterior pituitary. All right, so you know what a gonad is, right? Either a testes or an ovary. And there are two kinds of adrenal gonadotropins. There's one that's called follicle-stimulating hormone, which we call FSH, and the other is called luteinizing hormone. And let's just look and see what the effects are of gonadotropins are on the female. All right, so a female's ovary, the job of a female ovary is to produce an egg cell. Right? And an egg cell has half the number of chromosomes compared to all the other cells in your body, and they're not all competent at one time in your life. Right? There's usually one, maybe two or three, once during a month, one of these egg cells will mature so that it can be fertilized. And follicle-stimulating hormone causes the development of a follicle that contains one of these egg cells and causes it to mature. Right? But that egg cell, even though it's mature, inside of a follicle, can't be fertilized by a sperm. Sperm could go a lot of places, but can't go into a follicle. So that egg cell has to be released from a follicle, and that's where the second gonadotropin comes from. And it's called luteinizing hormone. Luteinizing hormone causes ovulation. So it releases that egg cell into a fallopian tube, and that's the last chapter that we're going to talk about in this class. So we don't really know where that is at the moment, but LH causes ovulation so that the egg cell can be fertilized, right, to produce a pregnancy. Right, so these are both gonadotropins, follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. The last one is prolactin, right, and that comes from the anterior pituitary. The cells that have receptors for prolactin are the glandular tissues of the breast. And it causes the glandular tissues to proliferate, which means grow. This happens during pregnancy, for instance, and maybe a little bit during different times of the menstrual cycle. But it causes the glandular tissue to grow. And the purpose of that glandular tissue is what? Milk production. And so prolactin is necessary in order for breast maturation so that it can secrete a competent milk product, right, to nourish an infant. All right, so that's prolactin in the anterior pituitary. All right, so here is the anterior pituitary, and you can see a nice vascular supply. So all of these hormones that I see right here, okay, are secreted from these glands, and then they travel through the vascular system everywhere in the body. Like where? Like the thyroid gland, gonads, etc., etc., etc. Okay. Posterior pituitary. Let's talk about hormones that are secreted from the posterior pituitary. That's not next on your word slide, but I think I want to get this out of the way by looking at the next illustration. So we're now ignoring the anterior pituitary, and we're looking at the posterior pituitary, and we see that it secretes only two hormones. And these are oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone. Oxytocin is a very powerful stimulator of smooth muscle, causes smooth muscle to contract. Not all smooth muscle in your body, but usually smooth muscle associated with the reproductive tract. So during parturition, oxytocin signals the uterus to contract, which produces, right, then delivery. Oxytocin is also a hormone that causes the glandular tissue of the breast. There's smooth muscle within the glands of the breast to contract, and then milk is released from the breast. We call that the milk letdown reflex. So what we've looked at so far in terms of milk production is one, maturation of the breast, which is prolactin, but prolactin won't release milk from the breast. You need another hormone, and that is called oxytocin, right? Oxytocin won't work unless prolactin has been available to the breast for it to develop, to produce competent glands, right? But oxytocin causes contraction of the uterus during parturition and also the milk letdown reflex. Antidiuretic hormone, right? What the heck does that mean? What does a diuretic do? Makes you pee, makes you lose a lot of water from your body, right? That's what a diuretic does. And an antidiuretic does what? The opposite. It helps you conserve water. So it tells the kidney not to produce a lot of urine, but to produce a little bit that's highly concentrated so that we can maintain fluids inside of our body. That's the job of antidiuretic hormone. All right, so that is the pituitary. Right, the hormones from the anterior, hormones from the posterior, but we want to look and see next time how these different lobes are controlled. And the anterior lobe is controlled by hormones released from the hypothalamus, but the posterior lobe is controlled by nerve signals coming from the hypothalamus. So here is part of the central nervous system. Infundibulum is part of the nervous system. And I can see myelinated axons going down the infundibulum into the posterior pituitary. All right, so what do we call these myelinated axons in the central nervous system? That is, I heard it, that's a tract. That's right, if it's in the peripheral system, it's a nerve. But here is a tract. We call that the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. It connects what? The hypothalamus with the posterior pituitary. There's a blood vessel that takes hormones from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary, which controls secretion of anterior pituitary hormones, right? And here we see that. I see a capillary bed in the hypothalamus, and then a blood vessel that picks up that hormone and brings it to another capillary bed in the anterior pituitary. Whenever you have a blood vessel that connects two capillary beds back to back, we call that a portal blood vessel. So here we have the hypophyseal portal blood vessel or vein right here. That's how hormones get from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary. So anterior and posterior pituitary are controlled in two different ways. One, hormonally, right, due to hormones from the hypothalamus, and one, okay, how is this posterior pituitary controlled? What do we call that when it's controlled by nerve signals? We call that neural stimulus, right? So the stimulus is different. Anterior is controlled, it's the very last one, is controlled hormonally. Posterior is controlled neurally. Right, so that's why we went over this slide at the very beginning. Okay, I will next time want to tell you what hormones are released by the hypothalamus that controls the pituitary, in particular the anterior pituitary gland. And then we're going to finish up the rest of the endocrine system on Wednesday. Okay, so here is the sign-in sheet if anybody needs it.